There is no anti-mimetics division. Part 5. The anti-mimetics division, knowingly and unknowingly, has been at war with a hostile cognitohazard, the likes of which reality has never seen before. They've bought as much time as they could to try to come up with a way to stop it for good, but time has run out, and things are about to get painfully apocalyptic real soon. Let's take a look. Chapter 11. Case Hate Red. If Adam Wheeler gave it some thought, or if someone were to prompt him with the right questions, he could put words around the fact that his existence didn't bring him any satisfaction. He would discover, on introspection, that he's nowhere close, actually, to happy, and that there is something vast and significant missing from his life. But he doesn't give it any thought. There's a void between him and those questions. Objectively, academically, his life is great. As a professional violinist, he does what he loves the most for a living. He has talent, recognition, challenge, variety, applause, a moderate wealth. What is there to question? Why shouldn't he love it? During slower moments, there's a gray worry in the back of his mind. It's there in the minutes right after he wakes up in the morning, before he makes it to the shower. It's there in the dead times backstage when he can't use his phone and there's nothing to do but wait to go on. It perturbs him, from time to time, that he seems to exist in a kind of long shadow cast by a vast class of thoughts which he is unable to think. But the rest of the time, on a day-to-day basis, his calendar is as busy as he and his manager can make it. He performs, solo and in orchestras. He records, he composes, and teaches. Every week is a different challenge. He keeps busy, and the feeling goes away if he's busy. On the morning of the day that it arrives, while he is brushing his teeth, a tiny black slug falls out of the corner of his eye into the hotel sink. He scratches that eye while drooling foam from his toothbrush. He takes a close look at himself in the mirror. Yep, there's another, fatter one growing in there, its tail protruding from his tear duct. I can do without this, he mutters to himself. He spits, rinses, and then takes a pair of tweezers out of his wash kit. Carefully, he nips the tiny, waving end of the slug and tugs it out. It's no more painful than extracting a nostril hair. He drops it in the sink with its friend and washes them both away, along with the froth of toothpaste. He stares at the plug hole for a long moment. It's like he's forgetting something. He can't bring it to mind. He shakes his head and goes to get dressed. Adam has been on tour with the New England Symphony Orchestra for nearly a month. They're at their final venue, and it's their final night, and Adam has mixed feelings. Touring, for him, is an opportunity to explore a kind of liminal lifestyle, where he can suspend a lot of worldly concerns and just exist as a being who wakes, travels, performs, and sleeps. But as novel as the experience is on paper, 4 weeks of it is grueling. By this stage in the tour, even the most naturally cheerful members of the orchestra have begun to show frayed nerves, and the program has become stale and repetitious. It's long past time for something else. Last night, his manager left messages about plans for upcoming weeks. It's probably time he paid attention to those. Morning rehearsal starts at 11. Adam takes a taxi from the hotel to the venue, bringing his tuxedo and his violin with him. His violin is an heirloom, more than 100 years old, and while he's touring, it never leaves his sight. His tuxedo is just a tuxedo. The concert hall is as close to the center of the city as it gets, at the heart of a rat's nest of busy roads, which means the taxi journey is a slog, even setting out after rush hour. At the stage door, the place is in chaos, but it's only the typical pre-show chaos which Adam has spent much of his professional life navigating. He finishes a quick cigarette outside, before joining the bustling flow of technicians, performers, and administrative staff. He finds his way to the dressing room, changes, unpacks his violin, and tunes it. He flicks through tonight's music, more out of boredom than a need to refresh his memory. He has the whole program memorized. With some minutes to kill, he checks the headlines on his phone. Yet again, something dreadful and new which he doesn't understand is going viral. Today's fad is, you paint a black vertical rectangle on the wall, or on a mirror, or over the top of a picture. And then you chant something. Adam can't quite pick out the words of the chant. They're in a language he's not familiar with. He's no singer, but he's performed pieces with lyrics in Latin, German, Greek, French, whereas this language has a bizarre, manufactured sense to it, as if it were simply English with the vowels and consonants all switched around. Rehearsal goes reasonably. Adam long ago swore that he would never coast through a performance, and he plays decently well. But it seems to him as if a lot of the orchestra is distracted. Some cues get missed. He makes meaningful eye contact with the conductor a couple of times, and they share a frustrated look. When they break for dinner, late in the afternoon, the conductor, whose name is Luhan, privately remarks to him, "Their eyes need fixing." Adam doesn't wholly follow. He rubs his own eye with a finger, reflexively. The memory of the morning tries to punch through, but fails. "You mean laser surgery?" Luhan responds with a few incomprehensible syllables and stalks away. The auditorium opens and the seats fill. As ever, there's a brief, gray, dead time while Adam waits for all the machinery of the performance to spin up. The anxious feeling is stronger than usual today. It grips him, an uncharacteristic urge to run away. "Sure," he thinks, "I could just junk my career right now. Pack it in and make for the stage door. Maybe the taxi will still be there." But he pushes through it. It's just a juvenile fantasy. It's been far too long a tour. One more show and it's over. And finally, it's time, and he's out there, under the spot, in his element. The first piece of the night is Shostakovich. Its first movement is a sedate, haunting, almost melodramatic nocturne. But before too long, the concerto changes gear and becomes energetic, discordant, feral. It's lengthy, too, a real workout, and much of it is brutally difficult to execute. He's on form tonight, close to flawless, and his audience, which he cannot see or hear, seems rapt. 4/5 of the way through the piece, a kind of spell breaks. Something changes in the atmosphere of the auditorium. The temperature in the huge room seems to rise by several degrees. More concerningly, and noticeably, the music behind him begins to trail off. The conductor stops too. Perplexed, he continues to play for a moment or two, keeping to his own internal time. But after another moment, it becomes clear that something is wrong, something which everybody can see but him. He steals a glance up from his instrument and finds that Luhan is staring at him. In fact, every musician in the orchestra is staring at him, all of them wearing the same expression of stony, barely contained anger. They've been replaced. The orchestra is gone. All 70 of them. The things which have replaced them are not human, but alien, ill-proportioned pillars of pinkish, brownish flesh. Each has, at its top, a heavy protuberance studded with goopy biological sensors and rubbery openings, and sprouting from the very cap lengths of various kinds of vile, off-colored moss. They are draped in black and white fabrics, weirdly cut to either conceal or highlight their blobby, inconsistent body structures. Adam reels with fright. He almost falls off the front of the stage. His stomach convulses and he wants to vomit, but a frantic fragment of his brain hasn't panicked yet and tells him, wait, nothing's changed. That's what humans have always looked like, right? What's happening? What's wrong? He glances, petrified, out into the darkness of the audience. The silent energy radiating off them has changed. They've been replaced too, he knows, and they know he hasn't. That's what's wrong. Clutching his violin to his chest, he stumbles across the stage, past the conductor, towards the wing. As he does, the musicians rise slowly from their seats, letting their own musical instruments drop to one side or the other. Adam trips over a cellist's music stand, recovers. The conductor is following him, with the other musicians close behind. Adam reaches the wing. There's a pair of stagehands there waiting for him. They have the same placid, angry expressions as everybody else, and the same set jaws. Adam stops and turns back. His heart feels like it's going to take off. Luhan, or rather, the biped which used to be Luhan, walks right up to him. He's a little shorter than Adam, but much heavier set. Rooted to the spot, not thinking clearly, he holds his violin up as if this will shield him. The conductor takes the instrument from his unresisting hands and breaks its neck underfoot, perfunctorily, as if crushing a box for recycling. Adam backs off, hands raised. He bumps into the disapproving stagehands who gently and wordlessly try to take hold of his arms. He shakes them off and is just about able to twist past them. He dives into the warren of corridors backstage, and then he runs like hell. Four floors up, in some remote, poorly lit corridor which hasn't seen regular use in years, he finds a bathroom. He goes in and throws up. This makes him feel a lot better. He washes his mouth out and then lights a cigarette, quickly filling the tiny space with a haze of smoke. That helps too. The adrenaline has run out, and his knees are still wobbling from climbing too many stairs. But it doesn't sound like anybody is closely pursuing him. So in this safe moment, he asks himself a serious question. Did I just have a panic attack? He doesn't know what a panic attack feels like. Having put so much distance between himself and the stage, what happened there feels like a crazed dream, a paranoid hallucination. But no, Luhan broke his violin. That part definitely happened. He remembers it with distressing clarity. His relationship with Luhan has never been much more than tepidly professional, but the man was a professional. To vandalize a precious instrument like that would be unthinkable for him, or anybody in the orchestra. There is something wrong with everybody, except him. He flicks his cigarette butt into the toilet. He grips the sink and looks at his reflection, and as his eyes slowly force their way back into focus, he realizes with some alarm that what he is looking at is not his reflection. The mirror above the sink has been sloppily painted over with a tall, black, dripping rectangle. It's giving off heat. Staring at it is like staring into an open oven. And he can hear a dull, grumbling, mechanical kind of noise coming from behind it, like distant, muffled wood chippers. He exits the bathroom and slams the door and leans against the far wall, watching the door, as if something could very well open it and come after him. There was another one, he suddenly recalls. Another painted block. This one on the wall in his dressing room, right behind his chair, facing the back of his head. He should have seen it in the mirror whenever he was sitting there, but he didn't. And not only that, there was one in his hotel room. It was painted over the picture hanging over his bed. Did the hotel staff paint it? When? Why? Why is he only remembering this now? The viral video isn't new. Why did he think it was new? It's been circulating for months, for as long as he can remember, forever. And in every venue when he's been on tour, in every city, on windows and billboards and in small rooms and liminal spaces, people have been painting these doors. There's a second half to each video. He remembers now. He watched it passively, over and over, and never saw it. Something comes through. It's been leeching into the background of the world this whole time, in plain sight, and he never saw it, and it's here now. He's having a psychotic break. No, that's not what's happening. Something is trying to interfere with the way he thinks. The block symbol is jammed into his mind. He can't dislodge it. He can't think about anything else. He looks back along the narrow corridor down which he just came. The darkness at the far end of it is yet another dark, vertical rectangle. He hears the footsteps of a multitude of people coming from that direction. Not running, just walking briskly enough to harry him. He needs to get out of the building. Get help. The stage door. He takes a confused zigzag route back down to street level. There's nobody in his way, and the stage door itself is unattended. He cracks it open. Night has fallen since the performance began. There's a minor road right outside, behind the concert hall building, a yellow-lit cul-de-sac with a loading bay and some unattended trucks. There's a major road adjoining the minor road, rammed with stationary traffic. Some of the vehicles are, indeed, taxis, but all of them are unoccupied, and most have their doors left open. There are colossally tall, darkened figures stalking down the streets, so dark and slender that Adam actually fails to notice them. There is screaming, a grotesque, awful screaming coming from many human mouths, coming from somewhere down the main road. But that's the only way he can go. It's everywhere, says his last sane splinter. Not just the concert hall, it's everyone. As he creeps towards the main road, someone, another occupied former human, pokes their head around the corner, then calls to others in the strange language, pointing him out. He stops in his tracks. In another moment, 10 or 11 non-people are advancing on him from the road. Two of them are carrying something with them. A limp, badly broken human. A normal human, Adam realizes with some shock, like him. The victim's heavy winter coat is torn open and his inner clothes are saturated scarlet. When the non-people carrying him catch sight of Adam, they toss the man violently aside into the street, where he lands in a pile against a car wheel. He grunts with pain as he lands, face down, and once he comes to rest, he takes a deep breath and lets out an inhuman, traumatized cry. But he doesn't try to move again. The non-people ignore him. Behind him, Adam hears the stage door swing open again. He doesn't dare glance back. This can't happen, says that last splinter. This is possible, yes. Real things exist which can do this to the world. But it doesn't happen. There's someone whose job it is to protect us from this. We're supposed to be protected. Someone stops it from happening. Someone steps in. At the last minute. But the last minute was a year ago, and she died. Marion. Oh, God. Help, he says, to nobody. A feeling of weightlessness rises up in his stomach. Gravity seems to upend and pitch him forward into the waiting arms of the non-people. They restrain him. They spend some time debating what to correct first, his eyes or his fingers. Right up until it starts, he's thinking, hoping, maybe it won't be as bad as all that. Chapter 11, Ara Arun. But it is. They wrestle him to the ground and pin his arm out flat, forcing his fist open to give access to his left index finger. The dread idea is beating on the door of his mind, demanding to be let in. It's wrong. The shape of it is awful, and it's too big and slick with poison, and he knows if he lets it in, it'll swamp everything he is, filling his home up with sludge and broken glass. It wants to drown him in it, and he knows it'll replace everything he is with itself. He knows it's taken the rest of the world already, and all of the people around him. And he holds out, and he continues to hold out right up until one of the people pinning him produces a chisel. Editor's note. A decent amount of this chapter is redacted, so I'll just read the erratic, unredacted parts. Overrides everything else. Yes, he says. Yes. He throws the door open. The world is ruined. Beautiful things, and smash them or cover them with filth. Find delightful people and disfigure. We who are drowning in and driven by it, who radiate. They who number in the billions and are. For the engine, in the center of the city, where people can be fed in and the door locked, irreversible. Intact and watching. This last splinter of Adam Wheeler starts to work against that which it knows to be wrong. A ray up there, a narrow, yellow, nourishing sunbeam. He follows it, over the top of the walls, and out of the city, away from the core. A kind of thread unravels behind him. An infestation. A black slug drops from his tear duct, falls to the asphalt, and shrivels. He regains consciousness on a hard, scrubbed floor in a wide, cool corridor. He's lying against one wall of the corridor, as if tossed there like a rag doll, with his back to the wall and his right arm stretched out, clenched into such a tight fist that his finger joints are hurting. He releases the fist, gasping. Disoriented, aching, he rolls and plants his other hand on the floor, and it's then that he discovers what's happened to that hand. He reacts as he must react. He clutches the stubs where his first two fingers were, and screams and cries hopelessly at the echoing building. Nobody answers him. The last thing he remembers, he was playing Shostakovich. He was flying through it, unimpeded. In his mind, he can hear what he was playing, note perfect, right up to the instant the memory cuts off. And he can't think of what comes next. Instead, that last, incomplete snippet of music goes around and around in his head, abruptly ending mid-note and slowly fading back in again from a few seconds back, an earworm. He can't jolt himself out of it. He's a stuck record. He can never play again. He tries to make the right shape with his remaining fingers. His hand won't do it. He rubs his eyes with his good hand. He feels like garbage, hungover, dehydrated. He's missing his shirt, and his arms and chest are almost gray with muck. He can never play again. He sits there, huddled for a long while, being small and unhappy and lost. He knows he's going to have to move eventually. He's working his way up to it. He looks up the corridor, eyes gradually recovering. He can see all right without his glasses, as long as he doesn't have to do much reading. He's in a school. There are notice boards, banks of lockers, a rainbow mural. The place is deserted and silent. There is a dull red light coming through the windows and the classroom doors on the far side of the corridor, suggesting that the sun is low on that side of the building, rising or setting. He has taught one-off music lessons in one or two schools, but he doesn't recognize this one. With some unease, he examines his bad hand. The stumps of his fingers are lumpy and uneven and have healed badly. A mass of scar tissue and scabs, and no stitches in sight, as if the digits were removed with great imprecision, hacked off, or bitten off. It troubles him that he can't remember. His memory is normally so sharp and clear. He thinks he's thinking clearly, but when he concentrates and tries to access the lost time, something in that gap pushes him back. A fierce red heat. It occurs to him that though his severed digits have healed very badly, they have healed. They certainly aren't bleeding, although there's a continual ache. How long would that take? How much time has he lost? What the hell happened? Way down the corridor, away from the classrooms, an office door is standing ajar. In that office, a telephone starts to ring. The office is pokey and dimly lit, piled high with paperwork. Two small desks, battered office chairs. He finds the ringing phone and picks it up. He asks, "Hello," and the synthesized female voice on the other end asks if this is Mr. Wheeler. He says that it is, and asks who this is. With a measured tone, the robotic voice replies that he has been sick for an extended period of time. She will be pleased to answer all of his questions soon, but not now. There is a woman in room W16. She is dying. Adam hesitantly replies that he's not a doctor, but the voice says that she knows. There is nothing he can do to save her. Nevertheless, he must go to her now. Adam says that he feels like he's not the best person to do that. He's not in the best place today. The voice replies that it has to be him. There's no one else. He asks who the woman is. There is a pause. It is as if the entity on the other end of the phone is unable to choose her words. She eventually says that the woman is significant and he should go now. She does not have much time. Adam is at a loss. He doesn't seem to have the strength to not do what he's told. He doesn't have any other direction to go in. The phone handset is corded, or he'd take it with him. He frets a little about not being able to take it with him. He asks the voice if she'll still be here, and she says yes. He leaves the handset off the hook. He goes back along the silent corridor. He finds the door numbered W16 and peeks through the safety glass into the orange-red lit classroom, squinting at the sunlight which floods it from the far windows. It's still not clear to him whether it's dusk or early morning. There is nobody in the classroom that he can see. He opens the door and goes in. There are elaborate, colorful biology posters and coursework displays. Desks in disarray, scattered books and felt-tip pens, brightly colored backpacks. He takes a pace or two up the central aisle, not seeing what he thinks he should be seeing, and turns around and jumps, startled. There is a huge chalk sketch on the blackboard, a highly realistic rendering of a woman's head and shoulders. He would swear the board was blank when he walked in. The image is moving. It's as if it's being drawn and erased and redrawn 5 or 10 times per second. The woman looks about his age. Her face is framed with masses of hair, although with the negative color effect of being drawn in white chalk on a black background, it's difficult to tell what color her hair ought to be. The one splash of color comes from the thick, bright blue frames of her glasses. She looks distraught, and she seems to be saying something. And though there is no sound, there is text written beside her. His name. He asks, "Yes." And she says that she remembers everything. The words scrum themselves out and become, "I can't forget a single minute of it." More lines come out. Each new thing she says erases the old. She knows everything he did now. She was blind, and he ran rings around her. She made mistake after mistake. He killed everybody she loves, except for Adam. After this, her lips stop moving. The last phrase lingers for longer than the others before scrubbing itself blank. Adam spends a long moment absorbing the final statement, turning it around, trying to figure out where, if anywhere, it slots into his life. He has never seen this woman before. But is that true? He studies her features, and his memory cycles around, and he unearths something deep and significant in his past. A bizarre encounter he hasn't devoted thought to in what feels like a century. Her. That one time at the hospital, remember? You gouged a chunk out of your foot backstage after a show. You spent half a night in the emergency room, and she was there, and you got talking. God, who was she now? A government agent, or at least in that sphere. She was unreal, on a whole other level from me. Tough, skilled, beautiful, sharp like a sapphire. We talked about music, film scores, and the trash which passed for TV sci-fi those days, and David Lynch. It was, well, you don't know that early, but it was promising. But nothing happened. They patched up my foot, and we never went anywhere. Did we? Marion, he breathes. He's almost got it. He holds a hand up, fearful, as if motioning for her to stop. No, this can't be. She says that she sent him away because she was trying to save his life. He remembers. It reconnects all at once, the years upon years of inextricable shared life. There's too much energy there. It crashes through him, violently. It's like grabbing a frayed electrical line. It's like being shot. He stumbles backwards, disbelieving. He never imagined how much he was missing. She says that it didn't work. He asks what happened to her, as he should have been there. Marion just says that he ruined the world, and now Adam has to live in hell. Adam asks where she is, as someone said she was dying. She replies that she's already dead. She's the memory. But now the memory is dying too. He's found his way into heaven, and he's ruining it, like the earth. Adam asks what she needs. He'll stop him. He'll help her. He'll do anything he can, as he loves her. She says nothing. After a moment or two, Adam realizes that her image has frozen. He goes up to it and peers at the chalkwork. Hesitantly, with his right hand, he reaches out to the heavy chalk shading of her hair and touches it with one finger. He leaves a dark dot. The chalk dust is real, on the board and on his finger. She's just a drawing. She's gone. It's all gone. He blacks out. He regains consciousness on a hard, scrubbed floor at the front of a school classroom. He's lying there as if tossed beneath the blackboard like a rag doll, one arm stretched out along the wall. He rolls over, gasping, and plants his other hand on the floor, and it's then that he discovers what's happened to that hand. "Dear God," he says, staring, uncomprehending, at the mangled stubs. In a strange, abstract way, the loss of his first two fingers just doesn't connect with him. It's as if he woke up already accepting it. What the hell happened? He compares his left hand with his right, which mercifully is pristine. He flexes them, mirroring the action as best he can. There could be a little nerve damage in his left hand. He'll have to talk to his specialist. But he should be able to wield a bow. "I suppose I'm playing left-handed from now on," he says to himself. Good God. How long is it going to take him to get to the same level of proficiency? A good while. He thinks back. The last thing he can remember is playing Shostakovich. He was flying through it, and he was having no trouble. He can almost hear what he was playing, note perfect, right up to the instant the memory abruptly cuts off. But he can't think of what came next. Instead, that final snippet fades in again from a few seconds back. Repeats itself right up to the cutoff point and stops, almost with an audible click. It's an earworm. He feels like a stuck record. So he does what he always does, hums a different song to displace it. He feels strange. He's hungover, dehydrated. He's missing his shirt, and his arms and chest are almost gray with muck. And he is dying, positively dying, for a cigarette. But he feels strangely upbeat, as if he's recovered from a prolonged illness, as if the worst is over. He gets up, eyes gradually recovering. He can see all right without his glasses, as long as he doesn't have to do much reading. The classroom is silent, lit red-orange from a sun which could be rising or setting. There are elaborate, colorful biology posters and coursework displays, desks in disarray, scattered books and felt-tip pens, brightly colored backpacks. The blackboard is blank. Adam has taught one-off music lessons in one or two schools, but he doesn't immediately recognize this one. Way down the corridor from the classroom, an office door is standing ajar. In that office, a telephone starts to ring. The office is pokey and dimly lit, piled high with paperwork. There are two small desks, each with a beaten-up office chair. Each desk has a phone, one of which is off its hook. He puts it back, obeying a hardwired instinct to tidy up. It's the other phone which is ringing, though, of course. He says hello, and a synthesized female voice asks if this is Mr. Wheeler. He says that it is, and asks who it is. With a measured tone, the robotic voice says that before they begin, does the name Marion Hutchinson mean anything to him? He replies, not as such, and asks if it should. The synthesized voice makes it impossible to tell whether the caller is dismayed at this, indifferent, or relieved. No, she says. Her name is Ulrich, and she's part of an organization called the Foundation. The objective of the Foundation was to prevent what has happened from happening. Adam turns around, suddenly afraid, but there's nothing behind him. He asks with some trepidation as to what has happened. Ulrich replies that the world has gone to hell. Adam just says, bad luck there. There's a long pause, long enough that Adam wonders to what insane degree he might have understated the situation. She finally says, yes, very bad luck. They need his help, and by we, she means she needs his help, because there is no one left of the Foundation but her, and she has no one but him. And she is dying. He replies that he's very sorry to hear that, and he finds that he means it. He chooses his next words with some care and asks what she needs. Ulrich replies that she needs him to find a man named Bartholomew Hughes. She tells him to take a seat, as she'll explain everything. Chapter 12. Unthreaded. Marion Wheeler used strong Nestic medication nearly every day of her life. Among the identity warriors of Mobile Task Force Omega Zero, Ara Arun, it was never in doubt that, on the occasion of her death, she would ascend into the noosphere. She would become a Beta Ramjin infomorphic entity, or a Type 6 volitional spiritual apparition, or a ghostie, or however she wished to describe her new self. Then she would join the citizens of Heaven and continue the Anti-Mimetics Division's fight from higher ground, likely with fearsome effectiveness. But Marion died under terrible circumstances. The Class Z drug which killed her did more than reinforce her memory. It destroyed her ability to do anything but remember. She ascended, arriving in the noosphere to a hero's welcome, but what arrived was an idea form so severely brain-damaged that it was barely able to communicate. After she was made as comfortable as possible and an initial diagnosis had been made, Sanchez offhandedly described her as a Swiss watch filled with glue. Ulrich yelled at him for saying it and would have hit him for his callousness. How can she make it to Heaven sick, she said. Isn't that just hell? The director apologized in the corporate, false way in which he always apologized for anything. How much more does she have to go through? Ulrich said. Who deserves this life? It hurt all of them. Regardless of personal investment in the mission, it was difficult not to care for someone whom they had watched and guarded for years. They continued to take care of her in the same way they always had, in shifts. Marion, dimly aware of her condition, worked against the problem in the instinctive, fierce way she worked against every problem. She slowly became more coherent, but never became herself again. Ulrich, on her shifts, saw that Wheeler spent most of her existence reliving her final moments over and over. She would recite what seemed to be half of a conversation with SCP-3125 itself, a conversation which several of Omega Zero said they recognized from Operation Cold City. Ideas can be killed. Ulrich asked Marion where Bart Hughes is, as he's the only one who can stop this now. They know he's alive, or he'd be here with them. She begs Marion for just a hint. She was trying. Ulrich knew that she was trying to say, "I don't know. I can't remember something I never knew in the first place." But all she could manage was, "with better ideas." Sanchez told Ulrich to keep pushing her, at least once per shift. Ulrich argues that the questioning is causing her considerable distress. They know she doesn't know anything, and it's cruel to keep trying. Sanchez replies that SCP-3125 is coming. With the quick arm of the Anti-Mimetics Division eliminated, there's nothing left which can stop it. Their real-world investigative capabilities are negligible. Hughes's sister doesn't know anything, and this is their sole remaining lead. He knows that she admires Marion more than anyone. Ulrich says that she mentored her, drove her to be the best person she has ever been. She honored her memory when she died, when even her own family wouldn't. They are the saints who guard, and she will guard her. Sanchez paused. Ulrich's devotion to Marion, and the lesser devotion of the others, irked him mildly. He viewed Marion as competent enough, but ultimately a failure. She was as much of a failure as everybody else in the division, with the only uninteresting distinction of being the last of the failures. But he was vulnerable to the kind of rhetoric Ulrich had just employed. It stoked a kind of fire inside him. Heaven knew he used it in his own communications often enough, for exactly the same purpose. He concedes, and says that the trawl in reality is continuing. There's a faint chance they'll find something of substance. He tells her to carry on as she was, with no questions. SCP-3125 incarnated the following winter. Its first act upon its arrival, or depending on the degree of intelligent agency you ascribe to it, the first side effect of its arrival, was the neutralization of the Foundation. In the space of a night, an international staff of tens of thousands disappeared into oblivion, or became amnesiac, or simply dropped brain dead where they were standing. Foundation sites became hollow, inaccessible dead zones. A few anomalies broke containment in the chaos, to devastating effect. Thousands of others were choked into irrelevant obscurity beneath SCP-3125's anti-mimetic pressure. The world can only end one way, it seemed to be declaring, gouging its statement into the flesh of reality. My world. My way. SCP-3125 had skirmished with Omega Zero before, but it had always been unclear how much information about Omega Zero it retained between skirmishes. In fact, it was unclear, fundamentally speaking, how SCP-3125 thought at all. Its behavior was inconsistent, unpredictable, and frightening. Records of its activities were cognitohazardous, discouraging close analysis. In the end, the question proved to be academic. When SCP-3125 arrived, whether it knew Omega Zero was there or not, it took no special action against it, and had no need to. Most of Omega Zero's members' anchors were Foundationers, or Foundation-adjacent. With those people's minds blown away in the first strike, the dense web of mutual memory which had held the task force together since its formation tore loose. More than half of the task force was cast into the void and died. The final, real death they had evaded for years. Around dawn, Eastern Standard Time, Sanchez announced that it was no longer possible for Omega Zero to stay together as a single entity. He split the remains of the task force into three. Ulrich and the malformed memory of Marion were assigned to the same sub-team. Sanchez gave final instructions to continue to search for Bart Hughes, or any kind of ally among the living, be they Foundation or Group of Interest or civilian. But the instructions were confusing and incomplete. It was because Sanchez didn't have an iota of faith in what he was saying. He couldn't see a way to the far side of this. It was about little more than survival now. It was about figuring out terms on which to face death. Ulrich never saw him again. She fled, with Marion and the others in their little sub-team, across the face of a noosphere which was rapidly becoming uninhabitable. The world was warping around SCP-3125's presence at the core of human thought, like real space around a black hole. It was building things, real physical artifacts in the center of cities. It was extruding them as if from spores, monumental concrete structures into which people were being fed in dizzying numbers. It was difficult to know what was happening inside of the structures. Some of the millions were dying in there. Some weren't. Ulrich didn't look. They found out the ugly way that it was dangerous to look closely. The sub-team was steadily running out of anchors. It could have been a systematic purge, but it could just as easily have been simple statistics. Roving physical and psychic anomalies, vast in their own right and slaved to SCP-3125, were combing the Earth, stripping it of objectors and feeding them into SCP-3125's maw. Ulrich's own anchor, a woman who had never known what the Foundation was but who remembered Ulrich with a heavy heart nearly every day, was killed around that time. Found in the hills where she'd been hiding and dragged down into the inferno. Ulrich wasn't looking. She didn't find out until it was too late. She felt the thread of memory come loose and followed it, panicking, past its flapping end and down into physical reality where there was nothing. A collapsed tent. A scuffed out fire pit where everything important had been piled up and burnt. Who was she? Another Omega Zero operative asked her. Ulrich had never spoken about it. I only knew her for 2 days, Ulrich said. When I was younger, she saved my life, that's all. This was it, she realized. She was a career Foundationer, an experienced mobile task force operative, for God's sake. She had gone through unimaginable horrors and stacked them up as experience and kept going. But this, Julia's tent and silence and no Julia, was the worst thing she had ever seen. Short of hope and resources, the sub-team had to split again, this time into pairs. Ulrich stayed with Marion, clinging to her like a rock, remembering her and being remembered in turn. A cooperating pair could survive untethered for a little while, but not forever. They found shelter on a distant edge of the noosphere, in a clutch of arcane structures left there millennia earlier by a long-dead human culture. They were followed, though they didn't realize. One night, Marion managed to talk. She said, "Adam." It was the first thing she had managed to say which wasn't a direct quote from her own expiring moments. Ulrich was shocked by this, asking if she remembers him. The sentence came out agonizingly slowly, as if each syllable was like climbing a mountain. She remembers everything. Ulrich stared. She knew that Class Z Nestics made it impossible for the subject to forget, She also knew that they could cause long-erased memories to reassert themselves. Some of them, anyway, depending on the mechanism and intensity of the erasure process. She had hoped that Marion's memories of her husband were permanently gone, because she knew they ended in a terrible place. Ulrich had to tell Marion that she doesn't know where Adam is. It was the truth. Nobody did. Omega Zero operatives had, with some solemnity, observed the erasure of Adam Wheeler's mind. But out of respect for Marion's decision and to preserve Adam's safety, they had intentionally diverted their attention during his relocation, destroying the records. He might be alive, she says, but she doesn't know. She didn't know which alternative was worse. Marion tells her to look. She was holding something in her hands, a pitiful, glowing idea form, a thought of someone. It was him. A thread of memory which led right to him. It was some kind of miracle. It had to be. That Marion had picked him out from the livid, insensate mass of victims which now formed SCP-3125's core. He was nearly unrecognizable. He was overrun with SCP-3125. At first glance, it seemed to occupy every nerve in his body. But there was a flickering seed in the back of his mind, a final remnant of what he had once been. It wasn't growing. There was too much pressure, but he was trying to. He was pushing back. Ulrich boggled. She had known that there was something weird and highly rare about the way Adam Wheeler's mind was structured, a kind of thick-skulled resistance to external interference. In fact, she knew that thousands and thousands of people in the world shared that immunity. But that was another way of saying that among the billions, such people were fantastically rare and difficult to locate. Efforts by Omega Zero to locate them and recruit them as allies had failed. They did not look special or behave radically different from others. There was no signal flare which went up. It was possible that they were all dead. It was conceivable that Adam Wheeler was the only one of them left in the whole world. But he was left. He was alive. Ulrich says that she sees him, but Marion doesn't respond. Ulrich tells her that she'll get him out of there. Her stomach was knotting up with the sheer thought of attempting it. Marion doesn't respond. 6 original, coherent words had exhausted her. She was crazed with frustration at how incapable she had become. She felt as if she was pinned beneath a huge lead block of memory. It hurt to think. It hurt to exist. Ulrich's ability to interact with the physical universe was extremely limited. Other operatives of Omega Zero had been able to create full-on poltergeist activity, changing the temperatures of rooms and throwing furniture around, but she was not that kind of specialist. She could do little more than place phone calls and write on walls. Those abilities weren't likely to get Adam Wheeler moving. Simple words were never going to reach him. The man wasn't even truly conscious. What Ulrich could do was something the task force dubbed identity offense. She could interfere with the internals of living minds to make things happen. Usually enemies. Usually the mental equivalent of blunt force trauma, to make them die. But she could act with surgical precision, if it was called for. Operating on Adam Wheeler was difficult and time-consuming. His mind was tough, and it was continually bathed in SCP-3125's radioactive presence. Ulrich would cut, and then wait as Adam's mind self-healed, which took days, and then she would cut again. The seedling metaphor served well. The operation reminded her of tending a plant. If nothing else, the whole procedure took real-time weeks. The patience required to keep her hands off for days at a time was nearly inhuman. Marion said nothing else in that time. She was conserving energy. It felt as if she had a finite number of words left in her, and speaking each one brought her an inch closer to the end. She had to wait. Ulrich assures her that he'll be here soon. Now, Ulrich watches from a great abstract distance as Adam Wheeler folds up. Marion Wheeler is dead, finally, truly dead, and Adam Wheeler's mind is breaking apart. It's an awful and incredible thing to watch. Even passing into the maw of SCP-3125 and back wasn't enough to permanently break him. But this was it. The silver bullet. This was the way to hurt Adam Wheeler in such a way that he would never recover. Present his wife to him, a brain-damaged wreck, just in time for her to die. Ulrich writes on the blackboard, off to one side so as to not mar the image of Marion, and in different handwriting, "I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Adam, please come back to the phone. I need your help." Adam is prostrate on the floor and becoming catatonic. He doesn't hear it when Ulrich tries calling the other office phone, the one on the other desk. And she too is dying now. She and Marion were anchoring one another as best they could, but it's the end of the line. She has, perhaps, hours. "All right," she says to no one. There is no one else left. She rolls up her figurative sleeves. This will not be too difficult for her. Adam Wheeler's revived memories of his wife shine inside him, and around the edge she can see the faint scar where they were burnt out the first time. She has a better vantage point. She can do a cleaner, more permanent job. This will hurt, just as much as it did then. Adam, face down, says that he needs her and begs her not to take her. Ulrich writes, "You need to save the world. There's nobody else." Adam doesn't look up, but he says, "To hell with the world. It can burn." He recovers a second time. He's fine, upbeat, game, eager to get moving. She explains everything she can, tersely, just the keywords: the Foundation, the Anti-Mimetics Division, the situation, the objective. He absorbs it all surprisingly well. He asks cogent follow-up questions, which is always a positive sign. He asks about the thread of memory which was sustaining Ulrich, and if he counts, as he'll remember her. She replies that his memory could be strong enough, but he just doesn't know her well enough. Ulrich tells him, in detail, how to find Site 41. It's going to be an immense trek, made significantly longer by Adam's need to avoid urban areas. She describes the anti-mimetic shroud which obscures Site 41 and most other Foundation sites, a shroud she and the rest of Omega Zero found to be totally impenetrable, a shroud which Adam, if he prepares himself, may be able to walk straight through. She warns him about the psychotic hurricane-like anomalies and the violent roaming agglomerations of SCP-3125-occupied non-humans. She describes a few techniques for avoiding their attention. She decides not to voice her private hope that, as a recent escapee from SCP-3125's interior, Adam will still smell right to them and be able to pass. She doesn't want him becoming overconfident and incautious. She explains basic survival skills. Adam says that he hikes and camps. Still, he has never hiked or camped in an occupied foreign world. He has never gone months without electricity and plumbing. They find that they have plenty to talk about. They're on the phone for long enough that Adam notices that the red sun outside the office window isn't moving. It hasn't risen. It hasn't set. Either the world's stopped turning completely, or the thing hanging out there isn't the sun. Ulrich has to tell him that she doesn't know. There was a Foundation which could answer this question once. Adam says that it seems like this foundation had the world's better interests at heart. In heaven, Ulrich laughs weakly. The foundation was never so simple, she says. Adam replies that he senses that they're coming to the end of their time together. She agrees. Adam says that the odds stacked against her were tremendous, but she saved his life. And the odds stacked against him are still appalling, but significantly better thanks to her. He'll do his level best, and he'll remember her, even if it doesn't make a difference. Ulrich tells him to kill this thing, and to not hesitate when he gets the chance. Adam says, "I," and at the same time, someone behind Ulrich laughs, sharply, once. She turns. There's a man there, standing with her in the noosphere. A gaunt, younger man with an awful, open-mouthed grin. He has been waiting, silently and excitedly, for an unknowable amount of time for Ulrich to notice him. And now that she does, he gets everything he could possibly want from her reaction, a rush of delectable horror and alarm. Then he cuts her off, killing her instantly, before she can get one syllable of warning to Adam. Adam hears nothing. A faint click, and then a dial tone. He hangs up. It seems that Marion Wheeler is now well and truly gone, and it's up to Adam to save the world. You have to hand it to the guy, as he now woke up with a mangled hand and no memories of his wife or the Foundation, and is told by a voice on the phone that the world needs saving and only he can do it. He pretty much is fine with it, of going up against an immense, hostile cognito hazard controlling the world and everything in it, with the goal of killing it. We'll see how his trek fares, and if he finds Bartholomew Hughes, in the next part.